Hello, Bill Resnicker for the Old Mole. Hi, John Pfeffer. Welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, great. John Pfeffer edits the online journal Foreign Policy and Focus for the Institute for Policy Studies. He writes a great deal of books and many op-ed style articles that address the great issues facing the world. His recent books include Aftershock, A Journey into Eastern Europe's Broken Dreams, and the book we'll discuss today, Splinterlands. It's set in the year 2050, which is not what so many dystopian writers have feared, a brave new world, totalitarian consolidation of power. Rather, 2050 in Splinterlands is the disintegration of all countries and blocs, and thus the end of the capacity to stop a relentless global warming that even now is undermining the ecosystems on which human life depend. So, John Pfeffer, tell us about the coming of Splinterlands. Then we can talk about how this absolute catastrophe, perhaps human extinction, can be avoided. First, though, what is Splinterland and why is it so likely?
Well, I began Splinterlands before the Brexit vote in the UK, the United Kingdom deciding to leave the European Union. And I wrote it also before the election of Donald Trump. But I imagine that these trends, which have come to pass, would only intensify between now and 2050. In other words, as you said, these larger blocks of nations like the European Union and multi-ethnic countries like the United States and Russia and China would begin to fragment, in part because of growing nationalism, in part because of growing economic inequality and political discontent, and of course as well because of climate change and increased competition for diminishing resources. Unfortunately, we have seen already since I finished the manuscript and since it was published an intensification of these trends, and so we are seeing the European Union begin to fragment, the transatlantic alliance in the wake of Donald Trump's recent visit to Europe begin to fragment. We have seen as well countries facing stronger movements for self-determination or for greater autonomy, whether it's in Myanmar or the Philippines or even in Saudi Arabia, where there is a Sunni-Shiite divide. So this is the coming of the Splinterlands, and I kind of project that into 2050, and I parallel a story of a scholar who is trying to understand not only the fragmentation of the international community, but the fragmentation of his own family.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Splinterlands. You write about the secession of the privileged and the elites, and in fact the military forces that they can assemble to protect themselves. That looks awfully like a variety of countries today that are failed states, that is, little fiefdoms now run by people with powerful militaries, or powerful enough militaries, and of course having to fight one another. You see that kind of failed state coming to, and it's indeed quite possible within, certainly in China and Russia, and in the U.S. also.
Unfortunately, I mean, of course, right now what we see are gated communities, and those gated communities have varying levels of security depending on the wealth of the people inside the gated community. You also see a new trend, not only survivalists who kind of create their own armed compound, but actually extremely wealthy survivalists, people who are dot-com billionaires who are spending enormous amount of money to kind of create their own armed compounds. And they have enough money to hire their own private security forces. Now, at the moment, that exists within democratic societies or within relatively cohesive societies. But as wealth begins to divide, as we have growing economic inequality, and as we have greater competition for a smaller pie of resources, then I'm afraid you're going to see the wealthy acquire more and more firepower to hold on to what they have or to get even more. And that's where I see a potential trajectory for even democratic countries like the United States.
Yeah, and it does seem to me that's quite possible in view of the fact that climate change it's going to have variable consequences across the globe. Some countries are going to be absolutely devastated, as in most of the South or much of the Middle East, where people are going to be fleeing, that is, those who can, and the others are going to be dying miserable deaths. But places like the United States, there are areas like the Southeast that are going to collapse. But there are areas like Cascadia, where we live in Oregon, that will still have a productive agriculture and be fairly productive. And those societies, it's not inconceivable. In fact, it's quite possible that the wealthy of those, let's say of Cascadia, will in fact barricade themselves against the rest of the country and world and try and survive. That's part of your vision, and it seems to me quite possible.
Well, it's part of my nightmare. It's part of what
yes.
And I mean, right now, when we talk about climate change, we largely talk about the disappearance of relatively small islands, Maldives, Seychelles, et cetera. And while the disappearance of those societies is unquestionably tragic, the scale of refugee flows is relatively small. But when we start talking about the potential disappearance of cities like Tokyo, Shanghai, Seoul,
New York, Miami,
exactly.
You know,
then we're talking
Long Island.
About enormous, enormous refugee flows. And where are those folks going to go? And you're right. There's going to be not only a competition over, you know, resources like energy, but there'll be competition for actual space, for just living space.
Right. This is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, listener supported, beholden to no one, independent, in fact, looking to that better possible democratic and sustainable world. I'm talking to John Pfeffer. He's the author of Splinterland and quite a few books, and he writes a lot. His blog is wonderful, particularly his analysis of the Trump administration now. We've been talking about the one of the possible worlds in 2050, which is the subject of Splinterlands, a novel, and it's the breakdown, the disintegration of the world system, and therefore the incapacity of any group to stop global warming, which is on the way to could in fact lead to human extinction. It might be avoided. You write some in the book. You point out, well, if we had done this and if we'd have done that, what do you see as the possibilities of now avoiding Splinterlands and doing it quickly?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, we need more international cooperation at this point, not less international cooperation. I'm hopeful that maybe we've reached a kind of high watermark in terms of far right wing populism in Europe, and that the European Union is going to survive this particular test, and that the European Union can kind of continue to lead the way along with several other countries around the world on the question of climate change. Of course, we have to do far more than what the Paris Agreement stipulates. As long as we can survive the next 3+ years here in the United States under Donald Trump, I'm hoping that we can, you know, put forward not only a kind of status quo ante, you know, the situation before Trump came to power, but actually a much better governance system here, better candidates, a better approach to dealing with international questions that embeds the United States in a cooperative way with countries around the world to tackle the most important issues. Climate change, of course, is number one, but we also have to deal with questions like pandemics, economic inequality, obviously still transborder conflicts. So building up that question, that elusive quality of solidarity within a country and across borders is critical to avoiding this nightmare scenario of the Splinterlands.
Yeah, unfortunately, my sense is, as you're like talking about Europe, the people running Europe, the sort of neoliberal elites of finance and capital, they don't seem to want to bend at all. They're ready to, in fact, extract the last bit of bounty as they can from the working classes of Europe. And that runs really radically against the possibilities of a decent European Union, you know, relatively democratic, like the United States, which is even less democratic. How do we deal with that? And we only really have a minute. Well, we should have to talk about this again. It seems to me we're running into the power of concentrated wealth and capital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I mean, the leadership of the European Union at this point doesn't realize that the EU will only survive if it changes dramatically, if it becomes more accountable to its own citizens, and if it becomes, again, committed to what it was committed to at the beginning, which is equitable distribution of wealth within the greater European Union. That's a challenge the Europeans themselves have to engage in. There's precious little we can do right now at the moment in the United States under Donald Trump, but I'm hoping in 3+ years, or even after the midterm elections, we can kind of repair transatlantic relations and push for a more equitable European Union.
Yeah, John, we have to leave, but we could talk about this again. It seems to me there are things that we can do now, but we'd have to talk about them and at least create models and create an alternative and create a really contending left that the Democratic Party is not. Anyway, that's my last word. Sorry, John, I think you probably agree. In any event, thanks a lot for talking to us. And Splinterlands is really a good read, too, and it's not long, and it lays out really those possibilities so vividly. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Mama, mama, look there. Your children are playing in the street again. Don't you know what happened down there? A youth of 14 got shot down there. The cocaine guns are jammed downtown. The killing clowns are blood money men. Shooting foes. Washington bullets again. Cause every cell